listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Today is Wednesday, August 14th. We've got more great guests in the studio. We continue our Holly Shorts feature where we get from Catherine a lot of great filmmakers. So I'd like to welcome to the show, we have Derek Magyar. Welcome
hey.
To the show, Derek.
Thanks for having me.
You're the director of the film?
Yep, I'm the director and producer.
And producer.
Co-writer.
I see.
And actor.
So you're the mind behind the whole thing.
That's right, yeah.
Awesome. And we have Marceline Hugo. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Nice to see you. Nice
you
to be here.
And are you an actress in the film, or what do you do?
I am.
You are.
I have one title, actor.
Oh, okay. Actor it is. Well, thank
good.
You guys for joining us. And let's start a little bit about you guys. Derek, are you? Do you live here in L.A.?
I live 2 hours outside of L.A. in a place called San Ynez.
Okay.
Most of my childhood in Los Angeles. I mm-hmm. grew up here, and I went to school here, and then I went to college at Cal Arts and grad school at AFI. So I've spent a lot of time in Los Angeles, and I felt that it was time to move and start a family. So my wife and I have a beautiful 9-month-old baby, and we raise her in a more kind of rural, beautiful countryside area that's 2 hours from LA. So it's still commutable, and I can still come and work, but I get to go home and see horses and beautiful nature.
That's
and,
a great idea. You know, I think just to start thinking about that, because I'm thinking like maybe I should move, but I'm thinking of far away places. But you know, you can't beat the weather here. You know, say whatever you will about California or LA, but you can't beat the weather. You know,
it's a great state. It's a great state.
It really
it's not
is.
A great city all the time, LA, but it's a great state.
It really is. California. It's beautiful out here. You know. Yeah. And were you originally born here in California?
I was born in New Hampshire, but I lived there really briefly. I think I lived there 6 months. Then I moved to New York with my parents, who were both artists. And then they came to Los Angeles when I was about a year and a half old.
I see. What kind of artists are they in film too?
My father's a filmmaker, and he's also a professor. He actually ran the school that I went to for grad school, the American Film Institute. And he ran it before I was there for, I think, a decade. And my mother was on the arts and humanities side, working for the Getty and thing, places like that.
So, oh, wow. Yeah. So they've got great careers.
Yes.
Yeah,
they
wow.
had great careers.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So you come from a home where there's art anyway and film and stuff. So you think some of it rubbed off on you?
Absolutely. Yeah, it did.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very nice. And so you moved from New Hampshire at what age? How old
I was
were you?
I was 6 months when I moved.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So your family moved here pretty much.
Yeah, my mother moved to Los Angeles for the job working for the Getty.
Right.
It was enticing enough for her that she felt that she needed to relocate the family. And we came out and we moved and never looked back.
Sounds good. Wow. Do you go back to the East Coast sometimes?
All the time. My wife's family lives in New York, and we spend a lot of time in New York City and in upstate New York and Westchester, where her family lives in Purchase. And so I do go back to the East Coast, but if I'm going back, it's pretty much to New York.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And we have a New Yorker here, I believe, right?
Yeah. Hey,
Marceline,
hey.
You're from New York?
I am.
You see, I overheard something.
Get out of here. What are you talking about?
And is that your... Is that where you grew up in New York?
No, I actually grew up in Rhode Island.
Oh, okay.
Speaking of parents on some level, my father was French, and so I spent also a fair amount of time in France.
Oh, really?
As a little kid.
Uh-huh.
But then, you know, when you grow up, where do you want to move? I moved straight to New York City.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So.
And so you grew up in France, in Paris, was that?
On the outskirts of Paris, and then in Avignon, so in the southern part of France as well.
Beautiful.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Very nice. And how many years did you guys live there in France?
It adds up to probably about 15 years of my life. So now that I'm a little older now, there was a time there where I could say half my life, but not anymore.
Well, you might as well still say it.
Yeah, we're on radio.
Try to get people to argue with you. You know,
there you go.
It's not going to work. Very nice. And so what did you do in New York when you moved?
Well, actually, just because we are in California, after all, I went to grad school at UC San Diego and studied acting there with Alan Schneider, and who was a wonderful director, and then moved to New York and stayed there, basically, launched my career there. Jobs would take me. I started a lot in theater, and so invariably I would go to all kinds of different regional theaters. But then I started to be getting some film, Working Girl. Mike Nichols' Working Girl was my first foray into both comedy and film, and never looked back after that. And then for a fair amount of time, raising a child, all of them married, raising a child in New York, I spent more time doing film and television. Mm-hmm. And now that she's in college and almost out of college, right. I have more time to do both theater and film and television.
Yeah. Now, you were in San Diego. Didn't it occur to you to move to Hollywood first, where all the film is, or...
It crossed my mind, but being a theater person at the time, particularly focused in theater,
and, New York is better.
And area. I'm a character actress, and so back in the day, you had to be young and pretty and blonde. So yes, I'm pretty, and yes, I'm blonde. And
yes,
I was young.
Absolutely, she has all of those qualities.
You got what it takes.
So the grit and the. Not that you don't have it here, but the definite you have it in New York of tell it like you see it, kind of straightforward talk,
right.
Fit my personality. So New York was calling me much more strongly than L.A. at the time.
I see. So are you still in New York now, or did you move to...
I am, but I did spend some time in L.A. In the 90s,
mm-hmm.
and I loved it. First of all, I love to drive, so I fit right in that way. But also now coming back, spending a little time with this film, and I have rediscovered how quickly one remembers, oh, yeah, I used to zip here, and then now you go around that way. And the only thing I miss is that big, heavy book you used to have,
yes,
which I became
Thomas
very
Guide.
Good at. You know, page number 94. Okay.
I know. Wow. People can't believe we have that
page
here.
I remember Thomas Guide.
Page number 62. Yes. Okay. Now I turn left.
Before GPS,
It was great.
Yeah.
But It's like an old home in some ways. My memories of driving around and having a great time in the 90s here in LA.
Yeah, and now you're out here for Holly Shorts, pretty much.
I am. I'm here to haunt Derek and make this help make this film happen. It's also a wonderful short, so it's worth coming out here to spend time with everybody.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about the film River of Grass. I wanted to ask you, Derek. Did you like right out of school, did you start making films before, or is this your first major?
No, out of undergrad, I started acting. My background is in acting. I've been acting since I was a little kid.
Oh, okay.
And I was a working actor into my mid-30s, and then I went back to school and got my master's in directing. I directed a feature film right before I went back to school, my first feature called Flying Lessons, and it was an amazing experience. But I felt that I needed to hone the kind of technical side of the craft, that I had a real understanding of how to approach the craft from a supportive actor's standpoint and from an actor's viewpoint, but that I really wanted to kind of understand composition and kind of understand the craft of directing more. So I went back to school, got my master's in directing, and then since then have been directing nonstop pretty much ever since.
Yeah, so
anything
prefer,
that I can.
You prefer behind the camera pretty much.
I don't know. I
you still like acting?
I still love acting.
I see.
Yeah, love.
Yeah. That sounds good, you know. I don't know. I mean, I admire actors because they're able to become someone else, you know. For me, it's like I don't think I could only play myself pretty much, you know.
So some
I never
actors
tried
do
this.
That.
That's right. Yeah,
how good
themselves.
An actor they are, I don't know. But it doesn't take much to play yourself. But, you know,
You'd be surprised.
I admire. Really? Okay, well, I don't know. But, I admire actors because it's hard work. It's not easy, you know. You got to memorize lines and everything, you know. I don't know that I could do that, you know. So, it's pretty cool.
It's if I may, what I'm struck by is in some level it's pretty simple.
Right.
You learn your lines, you say them, and you try to be as real and believable as you can.
Mm-hmm.
But that line of saying your lines, knowing them, and being believable as best you can is the slippery slope. That's where the art comes in. And it is it is a simple process, but it is deceptively complex.
Yeah.
And that makes the difference between those who think they can act and those who can act. Because it really is something much more ethereal than just lines and saying them like you mean them. It's also encompassing and embodying someone who is not you and making that a journey of a real person that is not necessarily you but brings in parts of you. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that it is deceptively simple, mm-hmm. but not simplistic, and so it's not everyone who can do it because of that.
Yeah. Did you find theater more challenging as far as an actress or film?
Just different. I fell in love with the relationship an actor has with camera.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, the essence of acting and finding the character and the believability and the truth is true in whatever form mm-hmm. you perform it in. But I found that intimate relationship. I found that the camera liked me. I liked it back. And so there's an intimacy there of an exchange that I found intoxicating. That didn't make me miss the audience a relationship you have in the theater.
So. Right. I would imagine it's kind of intimate with the audience there as well, right?
It is.
You get immediate feedback.
But there's something powerful and loving, I find, mm-hmm. when a camera is just on you and following your journey. And not just following it and capturing your journey.
Right.
But, I mean, so that's where – anyway, that was an interjection. I didn't mean to –
No, it's okay. No. You're here to talk. Don't worry about it. You don't have
to
apologize.
Take it away.
It's okay. We have to fill 50 minutes, you know. We might as well talk, you know.
And then I was born in – no, just kidding.
Well, we already went over that.
Right.
But what are some of the – so and then you started in film. How long were you in theater before you decided – you know what, I'm going to try film.
Well, it was good old Mike Nichols who helped change that in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Up until before then, I was really exclusively in doing theater.
I see.
And Juliet Taylor casting. Juliet Taylor helped change that because she then sent me to do a Woody Allen movie shortly thereafter. And it's just cavalier to say the rest is history, but it became very clear that was a strong, powerful interest that I wanted
to
pursue.
That's what you wanted to do.
Yeah, and I had been working at Lincoln Center at the time, and I just finished being part of Uncle Vanya at Lincoln Center, so it feels like it bookends that theater will continue to fuel, but it was really in 1989 with Working Girl that I started to think, hey, this is really pretty fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
And, well, what I'm sure a lot of L.A. knows, you're told to go sit in your room, and then they call you in when you're needed for the scene you're going to be in. This is the first movie. It was Mike Nichols. I didn't want to leave. Mm-hmm. So they would say, Miss Hugo, can we interest you in your dressing room? And I'd be, oh, no, I'll just stay here. And he noticed it, and it amused him. He didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. But he allowed me to just – I stayed out of the way and watch everything that was going on, which I think every young actor should do when they're on film. Anyway, mm-hmm. at one point, he got frustrated. Things weren't working well, and I was way in the back of the room, and he stood up not looking at me, and he said, well, Marceline, what do you think? I look – because he knew I had watched everything.
Yeah.
So there is a – so, yes, that passion and that desire was born on that week of shooting with Mike Nichols.
Sounds good.
Great story.
Did you have any desire for theater, or were you directly into film?
No, I did. I started doing theater when I was a kid, right up the street from where I went to school. I went to a really liberal arts school called Crossroads.
Okay.
On the west side, and right up the street was a place called the Santa Monica Playhouse.
Uh-huh.
And so me and some of my classmates went there after school, and we started doing theater. And I think I was maybe 10 years old.
Mm.
And I loved it. It was going there after school and putting on these silly musicals with some incredible actors. Now, you know, Zooey Deschanel was in my class, and Jason Ritter and Kate Hudson. And these are all people I went to school with. And we would all do this this sort of training, more play at that age than anything. But we would put on a show. Right. And I fell in love with it. And then I was doing theater ever since. So I did theater all the way through high school. And then I went to Cal Arts, which is in Santa Clarita. Right. And it's a really great theater program. And that's what I majored in. I got my BFA in acting. Mm-hmm. And I did a ton of theater there, especially. You know, anything from Chekhov to Ibsen to Brecht to, you know, a lot of kind of classical playwrights to Shakespeare. Nothing really too modern, but amazing, amazing material. And I had an incredible time. And CalArts really pushes you to push the limits and the boundaries of what you're comfortable with and what you're comfortable doing. And I thought that that was really powerful for me as an actor. Right. And when I came out of college, I had a real sense of confidence in my ability to take on challenges and not be afraid of the work. Right. And it was after college, I started my own theater company with a couple of friends of mine.
Oh, wow.
Put on a couple of shows called Filament Theater. Mm-hmm. It's sort of still up and running, but we couldn't keep it afloat. It just it's too hard to keep theater going in Los Angeles. So we did a few shows that we were really proud of. Some adaptations of Romeo and Juliet called Farewell Juliet that I loved. And then theater kind of faded away a bit as I started working more in TV and film. And then my film and TV career kind of started taking off. And then theater kind of was more in the rear view after that.
I see. What were some of your early projects, like on TV, for example? What were you doing?
Star Trek was pretty early on. I was a recurring series regular on Star Trek, the last Star Trek before it got canceled with Scott Bakula. That was pretty early.
That's cool. What was your role there?
It was Commander Kelby.
Oh, yeah?
Commander Kelby. Wow. Yeah, it was
a
great part.
Well, you're still playing that role.
Oh, 100%. As a director. 100%. 100%. Commander Magyar.
Yes, sir.
So that was pretty early on. I did a really amazing independent film that I'm really proud of called Boy Culture. Mm-hmm. That was my first kind of foray into being a lead in a feature film. And that we shot in Seattle, and that I think has premiered at over 120 festivals and has done really well and was really kind of groundbreaking for the LGBTQ community. And that was pretty early on. And then I did, you know, anything from JAG really early on. I think every episodic that you can think of, I've pretty much done, except Law and Order, which I don't know why Dick Wolf does not want to cast me in anything.
So you're still a virgin.
I'm still a virgin. I don't know why he doesn't want to cast me. But I've been on pretty much every CSI or NCIS or, you know, Criminal Minds or all of those kind of shows. I've done them.
Right. Well, obviously you're good at what you do, but did you have like a good manager and agent, right, to get you in the door for all these jobs?
I did. I was lucky that I came out of CalArts and we had a showcase. Mm-hmm. All the major BFA programs in the country have that. You know, Juilliard has it, and North Carolina School of the Arts has it, Carnegie Mellon has it.
UC San Diego, where I went. Yeah,
UC San Diego had it. And really, agents and managers come to this event. You do a scene and they kind of check you out and see what you look like and check your headshot and resume, even though there isn't much on there at that time. Mm. And I got lucky and I got representation really, really quickly. And I got really, really good representation quickly. So I was very fortunate.
Yeah, and you're fortunate to go to great schools too, you know what I mean? You got some great education,
really,
you know?
Yeah, I was really lucky. I'm
very
really thankful.
Nice. Good for you. And Marceline, how about you? Did you early on find someone who would help you find the work and...
Yes, well, I went to Brown University, so I had an overall general solid education in undergraduate level.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, I did a fair amount of directing as well. And so why I say interestingly enough is several professors at Brown said, you should think about UC San Diego because not only as an actor, you want to continue that. And by the way, I say actor. I've switched from saying actress.
That's okay.
To actor.
Most people do. I have to get used to it also.
The connotation of actress is still lingers, at least in my generation. So actor it is. Anyway, So they suggested that because Alan Schneider, who brought Beckett to the United States, who directed the original production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Alan Schneider was also there. And they thought he would be a great mentor for anyone who might be interested in also pursuing directing. Well, and he took me on as his research assistant. So I didn't have to do much work. What I had the privilege of doing was reading all of the letters and from groundbreaking people that he would have exchanged with, because his whole archive was available to me. Mm-hmm. So that led to a good foundation in acting at that program, and then, as you say, the league auditions, where you get a chance to, in my case, you did two different little scenes, mm-hmm. and you would find it contrasting scenes. And what mm-hmm. I found interesting, it's revelatory and it makes sense to me at this age, but at the time it was surprising to me that the knockout, drag-out comic piece I did mm-hmm. was all fine and made everybody laugh. But I also did Miranda the last Shakespeare play is...
That's okay. Right, that's okay. It's fine. It's okay. You're playing.
Anyway.
It's okay.
And so that was closer to my age mm-hmm. as an innocent young girl. Mm-hmm. And that was what casting directors and agents responded to.
I see.
I would not have been cast. I was a large girl and all of that. I would not have been cast as her normally.
The Tempest.
Thank you. That's embarrassing, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm sorry. I forgot to.
It's okay.
Was it Bill Shakespeare? William Shakespeare?
Bill.
Billy.
Billy. There you go. Anyway, so I realized that ultimately in this business, what they're looking for is truth. Mm-hmm. And I learned that very quickly right in those moments when the business didn't seem to welcome me in my mind for my visual, but they welcomed me for the truth of what you can perform and be if you give your soul to it. And so that quickly led to a lot of casting directors wanting to submit me to different things. Mm. And over 6 or 8 months, I got a good agent. And not the same one I have now, but now the agency I'm with, I've been with for 30 years.
Oh, wow.
So you look for a relationship with people, and then you grow with them. And so I think I'm leading to the question.
That
was the foundation of how that happened. In terms of getting into the business
And knowing good people that actually want to help you.
So Alan Schneider was, and then he tragically was killed in London. Looking to the left instead of the right, and a motorcycle killed him, unfortunately. But he gave me the foundation and the connections, and then. The usual auditions and proving who you are and having to work hard and not make the mistake I did in the first audition, for anyone who's in the situation where you're like, it was so hard to get the audition. Now I finally have the audition. Now I'm going to get the job because that was the hardest part. And you're like, well, that's just the beginning of the work you have to do to get the job.
But that's true.
But
that's true.
Then, you know, the process of auditioning and finding people who want to cast you, and that's been steady and smooth from the beginning of.
And you've been working regularly since then.
I have.
That's amazing. You know, to do what you love to do, and actually be able to pay the bills from that is amazing. You know, everybody would like to do that, but you know, when you come to LA, there's so many people. It's like take a number and get in line. You know, because mm-hmm. there's so many people all wanting to do the same thing. You know.
Yeah. Well, there's you have to start somewhere, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I temped. My making the ends meet at the beginning was temping, mm-hmm. But then after a while, the ideal is that you make enough money to pay the rent without having to
actor.
Do that. Yeah, a working actor. Exactly.
Yeah, that's an exciting moment when you realize that you can finally pay all your bills based on your work alone and not some other part-time job or some other way of hustling, that it's just acting or directing, and it's very fulfilling to realize that you're able to make your way.
Yeah, you know. That's awesome. So let's get to River of Grass now. Derek, you came up with the idea with the concept for the film?
Yeah, I came up with the idea for the concept of the film, but not for the concept of the whole metamorphosis of the project isn't mine solely. It's something that I share with two other writers that I worked with. One in particular, Chad Christopher. It's sort of based on his family lore, sort of based on real events that happened in the Florida Everglades in the late 60s. So it's sort of based on his family and his life. But I took what he gave me, which was a pilot 3 years ago, 3+ years ago. And it was a lot of interesting ideas, but it wasn't kind of formulated at all into something that made kind of cohesive sense. It was a lot of kind of, this is a great idea and that's a great idea, but like, how do we bring it all together and make it all work? And it started as a pilot and a television series, and it was kind of pushing in that direction. And then some producers got their hands on it and said, we'd love to kind of see what this looks like as a film. And it got written as a feature, and it is being made as a feature, which is really exciting, in January of next year. And in the interim, it started actually with an agent at, I don't remember which agent. I don't remember which agent. But anyway, an agent, I think it was Mark's agent. It was an agent at UTA who suggested that I consider making a proof of concept, and that the proof of concept would really help also serve funding for the feature, as well as kind of showcasing the visual language and how I kind of see the film getting made and all these kind of things. And from that, the short was born, and the rest is history, I guess. You know, I think we kind of we picked scenes that were already existing in the feature, and then we figured out how they would best work together and kind of gel together and make the most interesting kind of dynamic story in under 20 minutes.
Yeah. How did you connect with them? How did you guys come together?
The writers?
Yes.
The writer who came to me with the initial story idea knew me through her ex, her ex-wife. We went to CalArts together.
I see.
She and I went to CalArts together, and they were together for a long time. And she was like, you have to meet my friend Derek. You know, he also likes to kind of – I like to, you know, produce, and I was starting to get into that. I had produced my first feature film as well, so I was sort of dabbling in that as well. And that's how the introduction first happened.
I see. Now, the person that wrote the screenplay, the story, is that the main character in the film? Is it about him?
No, it's the what's about him is actually not in the short.
I see.
I mean,
okay.
That's not totally true, actually. Some of the family dynamics, which you see in the short, that is sort of going along the lines of his family. But in terms of sort of what the story is about of the short, that is not connected really to his family.
So that's just an idea that came to him, but it was based on a true story.
Yeah, I don't, you know, to be honest, I don't remember if that was his idea or my idea. I mean, we've been working on it for over 3 years, that part in particular. But the overarching kind of concept of a young man coming home from war and then getting involved in a drug smuggling empire and kind of it being this kind of big kind of action story, that spawned pretty much from him and me. I think we kind of gave birth to it at the same time, kind of a thing.
Very cool. So you were interested in the story. Where did you find out about it, about the story?
I found out through my writer friend. He just came to me and said, I have a story if you're interested.
So he wrote it first and then he reached out to you.
He wrote it first. He wrote a pilot and he hadn't taken it around too much. I think he took it to Lionsgate. They were interested, but they ended up passing. And then he showed it to me and I said, let's make this better and make this kind of something different. And what he had, like I said, was a lot of great ideas, but it wasn't a kind of cohesive pilot, and there wasn't like an idea for a show or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And we really spent the next couple of years refining it, and then, like I said, turning it into a feature. Mm-hmm. We were paid to write the feature, on spec, which means, you know, we write it, and then a a company either decides to buy it or doesn't buy it. And if they don't buy it, we still get paid, luckily. And we, then we get to shop it elsewhere, which is great.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, from there, the short was born.
Awesome. And what's the writer's name? We might as well give credit.
Sure. The writers are Chad Christopher. It's mm-hmm. his sort of based on his family lore. And then my other writer, co-writer, is John Block.
I see. Why was it necessary to bring in a co-writer?
John was somebody that I also went to school with, whose style of writing I've always kind of enjoyed. He has a real kind of dry sense of humor. I think we banter really well together, and I thought that he would add some interesting dissonance to kind of what I was bringing to the table as well as what Chad was bringing to the table.
Awesome. Awesome. And Marceline, how did you find out about the movie?
The classic way actors find out, which is Marceline, you're free for this next week, and they've just offered you an opportunity to come out to L.A. and do this short. Would you be interested?
Wow. How did you find out about her then?
I'd seen her work for quite some time, so I was familiar with her, and I thought she was great. And, you know, when we were talking about casting that role, her name was on a very kind of short list, and we were lucky enough that she was available and wanted to come out and be a part of it, and she's been amazing. She's been a sport the whole time. She's been great on set. She was an amazing energy on set. You know, she was always there on time and laughing and having a great time while we were working our butts off.
That's what mamas do.
There you go. That's right. Mama bear for sure. And she's been great in promoting it. You know, she flew all the way to Los Angeles to do this. And I think it just shows A, how much she cares about the film, and B, what kind of a person she is.
Yeah. How long did it take to shoot the film?
We shot it in production was 4 days.
4 days.
Yeah.
Okay. And how long is the film?
19 minutes.
19 minutes. Yeah. And from what I understand, the limit is like 39, 40 minutes for a film.
Yeah, that's pushing the boundary.
That's long, though.
That's pushing the Oscar boundary.
Right,
yeah. But
right.
You can technically submit up to 40 minutes.
I see. Yeah. But I would imagine it's probably harder to tell a story in a shorter time, right? Because you're trying to fit in
100%.
More. 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a different type of narrative. I think it's not a sort of full arcing story that you're telling. You're telling a piece of it. You're telling a kind of a specific part of the story, or you're kind of dialing in on a specific emotion or a specific theme, and you're kind of taking that and creating a journey out of that theme or that emotion, or that kind of that thing that you're kind of exploring through the short, and that's kind of what shapes it.
I see.
As an actor coming into all of the thoughts and the development that, of course, Derek has just described, what was remarkable in the spirit of what he's talking about is, so five actors show up, you being one of them, so you're at the pulse of it too, who come from their own specific and different lives. And I was the only New York energy. So for me, and I think there is something to that, because I'm not as familiar with some of the givens that LA actors know about each other in
right.
terms of dynamic. And so everybody showed up in electric cars, which of course was already like, oh, okay. So this is what I'm looking at. I won't mention the name, but one of my favorite of the actors also had an emotional support dog, and I thought, okay, I really am in LA. we as a group of different actors, different ways of thinking of things. Mm-hmm. Derek sat us down the day before we started shooting, and he asked a simple question. Mm-hmm. He said, "What is your favorite meal?" Mm-hmm. And I watched and felt and became part of, as well, the process of just disclosing my personal answer to that. And there was sort of a quietness that came over the group of us as we described what we liked either to cook or to eat and why. Mm. And suddenly we didn't come from anywhere but this little place mm-hmm. where we sat around as a family. And I I realize it is part of Derek's talent. He just is able to bring people together, focus them, rehearse them, prepare them, and then gently but clearly guides us through it. So yeah. I remember my answer was Thanksgiving dinner, which then, because I wasn't the first one to go. So by the time we were already feeling, so they're like, oh, well, what do you cook? And what do you, and we were suddenly talking about the different things we like and what made mine different from theirs. And, well, I'm a vegetarian, but I would like that too, you know, that kind of, you know, whatever the dishes were.
Right.
And the next thing you know, in the morning, that next day, it was as if we had gone on that journey of reading. We didn't know the pilot. We didn't know any of that. But it was as if we had read all the background that we needed, because we were a group that was being led by Derek, who knew exactly what he was looking for.
Wow. And did you do all the casting, Derek?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, I have an amazing casting director who also co-produced, Amanda Lenker Doyle. She's wonderful.
Fabulous.
And my wife has been a part of everything that I do. So she's by my side for everything.
And so you're the producer of the film as well?
I am a producer. My wife is also a producer on the film. But yeah, I am a producer.
That's cool. So that's like a lot of work. I mean, to produce and direct. Yes. And cast and do everything, you know, but
I didn't cast. To be fair, Amanda did.
Oh, she did
the legwork for that. I think what I was able to do is I was able, because I have been a working actor for quite some time, I was able to kind of pull some people together that I knew and just say, hey, are you open to doing this project? Some wonderful actors. And I was able to get some actors that way. And then there are a few parts that were cast the more traditional way. Marceline was one, Dylan was the other, and that's it. Those two, that's it. Okay. Oh, that's not true. I'm sorry. And Joshua, the character of Joshua, played by Darren Darborough.
Okay.
So three of them.
So what size cast did you have? About how many people?
Six, seven
people?
Something like that, yeah.
That's quite a lot for a short film, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think the scene with the most people was the dinner table scene, which was 2, 3, 4, 5 people around the table.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that's a challenging scene to kind of manage five different actors' energies. But I think we nailed it.
Six. I'm the one that accidentally said five earlier. It is six because Uncle
John.
The two.
Uncle John, Betsy, Will. Oh, yeah, I forgot myself. I forgot myself because I'm not in the feature. My character's not in the feature anymore, so it's hard to remember that I'm in the short.
I see. So without giving away too much of the film, tell us the basis of the story. Like you mentioned something about getting into the drug trade and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a little bit of background on the main character there.
I mean, that's not really in the short. I'm happy to talk about it. That's more kind of that is in the feature.
Okay.
Talk
about what's in the feature, the story.
Sure. So again, it's set in 1969 in the Florida Everglades, and the premise is the same. It's about a young man who comes home from Vietnam and has to kind of reintegrate with his family, as well as, you know, figure out what his place is in the family and also what his place is in the world. He's a homosexual in 1969 in the Florida Everglades, and that's extremely complicated.
Yeah.
And so it's about identity. It's about sibling rivalry. It's about family. And then the family business goes out of business. And the family is already involved in some illegal enterprises. They run in a legal casino, a gambling casino in the Florida Everglades in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And they also run a brothel. And they kind of have the villains, quote unquote, you know, are hiding behind, you know, the cloth in terms of who the villain is. Mm. They want their land to be able to continue to build on and you know, for mangroves and things like that, as well as there's some personal vendetta between the character of the pastor as well as the Johnson family. And so they're means of money is burned to the ground, literally. And so Larry, our protagonist, is given an opportunity to consider using his knowledge of the Florida Everglades and how well he knows the region to smuggle in marijuana. And this did happen in Everglades City in 1969. This is all true. All the drugs that were brought in before Pablo Escobar and the DEA were brought in through Everglades City, through the Florida Everglades, which is like a one-lane street. I mean, it's crazy if you look it up.
Yeah.
And that was all of the marijuana that was being pushed all the way up to Miami and all the way up to New York and then all the way across to the West Coast. That's what was happening before the DEA chomped down, which happened, I think, in 1970 or 1971. It was very short afterward.
Right.
But he's presented with this opportunity. He takes it because he needs to make money and he wants to, you know, figure out what his place is in the family.
Right.
And he's really good at it. And he makes a lot of money. And it also causes a lot of problems.
Right.
And through that, he begins to figure out who he is as a human being. And, you know, it's a love story. It's a really kind of layered thing that outside of these kind of beautiful smaller elements that I think are kind of the most important things of the film, family, love, relationships, that it also has this bigger kind of arcing theme of drug smuggling and cartel and all of those kind of things. So while there's a lot of really cool action stuff in this film, it's a story about family. It's a story about heart. It's a story about identity and this particular Larry's identity, right, and really how he finds his place through trial and error.
Right. I would imagine he probably brought a lot of baggage from the war. And
he did.
And that affects his decisions. And
he did. It's complicated. He's suffering from PTSD, and okay, I think he's suffering from PTSD on multiple layers, multiple levels. Sorry, I'm still somewhat tired. he is suffering from just PTSD from being there, from being a part of some really intense massacres that happened in Vietnam, as well as losing a platoon member that he was in love with. And he enlisted. He didn't get drafted. Larry chose to go. And he chose to go because he thought it would make him into a man. And that's what he thought his father wanted.
Mm.
And while it didn't really make him more of a man, it did, in the end, make him more of a man. Because it made him realize more who he was, even though when he came home, at first he didn't realize it.
Mm.
But it opened up the space within him to fall in love,
mm-hmm,
and that does happen in the feature film. He does fall in love, and that's really exciting. But he is really torn up by what he had to do over there, as well as not being able to save this one person in his platoon who he really loved and cared about.
Yeah, that's pretty heavy stuff, you know. I mean,
yes,
you know, I mean, when I look at soldiers as, you know, they take a person, they deconstruct you, and then they build you as a fighting machine.
That's
you
right.
Know?
That's right.
And
yeah,
and where do all your emotions go, you know, your feelings?
Totally.
I mean, you've seen things that you would never in a million years imagine you would see, you know, flying body parts, you know, losing your buddies and stuff, you know, seeing all this adversity. And how can you not have PTSD, you know? I mean,
yeah,
you come back and you're like a different person altogether, you know? So I can understand, you know, him coming back and really trying to fit in, trying to find out who he really is, you know, because I think when you go to war, you kind of forget who you are, you know?
Yeah, I think I have not served in the military, so I don't want to speak on their behalf, but I think from the research that I've done, it's about trying to forget about home as much as you can while still calling in and checking in with your family, your wife, and your kids. But when you are there and you are overseas, it's about focusing on the task at hand, surviving the task at hand, and making it back to base camp.
Yeah.
And family and all of those kind of things cannot be part of what's in your direct line of focus, because that will distract you, and that could be a problem.
Yeah.
And so it's about kind of finding ways to have kind of horse blinders on and just kind of stay focused on the task at hand,
right.
Handle it, come back, and then say, okay, let me touch base with my family.
I see. And Marceline, what's your role in the film?
Well, I've just lost my husband, who I tend to speak as if it's me. So
right,
forgive
okay.
me. I just lost my husband in the year before, and then my baby, who I babied, twin babies, but my son comes back. So my role is now the head of the household, the matriarch. I think in my sense of she was always a bit of the matriarch. Well, she certainly was, but she drove the household even when the husband was around, but made sure all the balance and checks and the bookkeeping was all done correctly and laundered in all the proper ways. But I think the mother's role is twofold in the sense that blinded by such pure love and support that doesn't want to see the frictions, but mm-hmm. then profoundly understands how important family is above and all, above and beyond any friction that could possibly be. So she represents to me, at least in thematic terms, that blood link that keeps us all together, the importance of land and ownership and the right to be somewhere that you've been for generations kind of feel. She carries that strength and power with her and is unwavering in that way, mm-hmm. and yet is challenged by the fact that things are falling apart and her children have other dreams and or are unable to cope and are possibly going to, and at some point maybe even be killed. And so that chips away at that purpose and sense of righteousness and sense of what is the right order when you have to shift to try to help your children who either are going to die or may die or are in danger. And
right.
It's the first sort of introduction when he comes back that PTSD, that he's unable to cope with certain emotions. And then the older son is desperately trying to prove himself and the friction of that. And then and this is where I love in terms of the role of the female voice that, in the short, it's much more the male voice. And in the story, it's still a male journey, but there's a female voice that is much stronger and more explored because it can in a full movie. There's also that even more of a relationship with the daughter and what the sister is and what she represents for the twin brother as well as for the family. So that's the essence of what I see as the mother, the role that that the mother plays in this, as the matriarch, as the glue, and yet as the one who has to change as well to be able to cope and help with her daughter who wants to become her own self, her twin younger brother who is suffering and needs help, and the older son who has tried all his life to be the man. It's mm-hmm. interesting, the discussion of trying to be what is man,
right.
But you know, that help him find his path and well, I guess there's my answer. There's
okay,
my answer.
Sounds good. Okay, well, we're just about out of time. The film is River of Grass. That I would imagine is a reference to the Everglades and
correct.
Probably to the marijuana too, right?
Correct.
Okay, there you go. So Derek and Marceline, thank you so much for joining us. Tell people, so you're in the Holly Shorts, right?
Yeah, we premiered last night at Holly Shorts.
Oh, it was already on last night.
Yeah, we screened last night. We were the first film in the block. And
what was the reaction? Were you guys pleased?
I'm not the right person to ask.
Yeah.
I think, you'd ask my wife or Marceline. I'm very critical. But I think the reaction was quite positive.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Well, I wish you all the best. You guys probably will be moving towards the Oscars somehow, right?
We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Well, like I say, you know, with Catherine, you never know because she's been associated with several films that went to the Oscar and
yeah.
that have been on the show before. And so you're in good company, you know. And
that's right.
I congratulate you for that.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the film.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for joining us, guys.
Thank you for having
us. Thanks for having us.
Of course. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you tomorrow.
You're listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.